So just read again the lines written in praise of Tara. The single face of the chief lady is the understanding of all events as a single knowledge. The green colour of her body is power in all faculties. Her two hands are the two truths. Her right hand the conventional truth. Her left hand the ultimate truth. Her wearing of all ornaments is the completion of the stocks of merit and knowledge. Her right hand in the gift-bestowing gesture is the contemplation of the perfection of charity. Her left hand in the protection gesture is the guarding of all beings from fear. Her right leg stretched out is the abandonment of all defects of Mara. Her left leg drawn back is the understanding of all qualities. Her holding of the lotus blossom is the bringing of joy to all beings. Her being 16 years of age is the ability to accomplish the aims of all beings. Her throne of the orb of the moon is the possession of the perfection of wisdom. Her throne of a very coloured lotus is the possession of the essence of compassion. So the two lines we're going to reflect on tonight are: her two hands are the two truths, her right hand the conventional truth, her left hand the ultimate truth. And then the second one: her wearing of all ornaments is a completion of the stocks of merit and knowledge. And we're going to do them in reverse order.
I'll scribble that out.
You'll scribble that out now. So, her wearing of all ornaments is a completion of the stocks of merit and knowledge. So what this refers to is the, you come across them in Tibetan texts, the two accumulations of merit, punya, and of knowledge, jnana. So the notion there is that in the course of practice, and that includes practice of ethics, but of course it also includes meditation, all the other practices we do, that beings rolling around existence from life to life, if that's the perspective you have, or within this life, that we accumulate punya and we accumulate jnana. So punya is merit in the sense of when you rejoice in someone's merits. And it's the punya of practicing. Well, for example, there's a little two or three verses in the book of Gradual Sayings, which gives a very delightful list of the punya, the merit that's accumulated by practicing metta. The word actually that's translated here is amiti, loving kindness. So the section is called Advantages, and the Buddha is speaking, and he says, monks, 11 advantages are to be looked for from the release of heart by the practice of amity. By making amity to grow, by making much of it, by making amity a vehicle and basis, by persisting in it, by becoming familiar with it, by well establishing it. So that list in itself would be good to take on board for any time we sit and do metta bhavana. Making it grow, making much of it, making it a vehicle and basis, persisting, becoming familiar, well establishing it. So 11 advantages accrue. What are the 11? One sleeps happy and wakes happy. He sees no evil dream. He is dear to human beings and non-human beings alike. The devas guard him. Fire, poison, or sword affect him not. Quickly he concentrates his mind. His complexion is serene. He makes an end, so he dies, without bewilderment. And if he has penetrated no further to arahantship, he reaches at death the Brahma world. So that would be a very auspicious rebirth. He hasn't attained insight, but hopefully he would have. But if he hasn't, then he will find a good rebirth. And these are the 11 advantages to be looked from the release of heart by the practice of loving kindness. Sleeps happy and wakes happy. No evil dreams. Dear to human beings. Dear to beings. Guarded by the devas. Not affected by danger. Able to concentrate one's mind quickly. With a serene, blemishless complexion. Dying without bewilderment, and if nothing more, then having an auspicious rebirth. So that's it's lovely, isn't it? It's lovely. Sorry?
Can I just ask where that's?
It's from the Paricana. It's from the collection of called the Gradual Sayings, which I can't quite remember what that is in Pali. It's not Samyutta. Anguttara, that's what it is. So it's from the Book of the Elevens. I'll leave it out and you can have a look at it. But it's very lovely. So that's what punya is. And so in this verse of Tara, the Nagarjuna's in reflecting on the form, he's reflecting on all her ornaments. So she has precious jewels and necklaces and anklets. She's adorned with ornaments, and one of his associations is that adorning of her body is like how merit adorns a being, and merit brings good fortune to a being, brings beauty and good fortune. And then the second of the accumulations is jnana, and that's accumulation of knowledge, and it's in the specific sense of the knowledge that you need to be able to take your next steps in practice. This is from memory. I haven't actually checked it. Actually, I don't even know where it is, but I know it's from one of Bhante's seminars when he said that the best merit is knowing what the next step of your spiritual life needs to be. So the best merit. Having good fortunates, having material, you know, goods enough to do you and or more, having all that's good. It makes for a comfortable life, and you can put it in the service of the Dharma after all. But the best merit is just knowing what you need to do next, what your next step in your spiritual life needs to be. If you have the jnana, the accumulation of jnana, just enough to tell you that. That's the best position to be in. And for the others, material goods and the rest of it are unimportant in comparison, though helpful in themselves. And again, Nagarjuna is just comparing all the ornaments of that Tara wears in her body with the accumulation of jnana. So in her case, it's the completion of the stocks of merit and jnana, because she's perfectly enlightened. She can't gain any more merit and jnana because she is completely enlightened. I suppose at that point, like I saw, you give it away and then you get more. But anyway, from her point of view, it's probably a thing of the past. Not any anxiety about gaining merit any longer or knowledge. So her ornaments, her wearing of all ornaments, is a completion of the stocks of merit and knowledge, because her enlightenment is complete. So even in that, just something to ask yourself, do you feel you have enough knowledge, whether it's self-knowledge, because you need that to know what your next step needs to be, and to have a bit of an intuition about that. You need self-knowledge, but perhaps you also, there are other kinds of knowledge that you might need. So just reflect on that. Do you know what, is it easy to, it's fairly straightforward to think, yeah, I think what I need to do is, Something simple. Make sure I go on solitary next year, within the next 12 months. Better to keep it simple, isn't it? It might be, well, within the next 12 months, I would really not want to get to the end of the next 12 months without having asked a couple of people to be my KMs, to be my Kalyana Mitras. So you'll know, you'll have a sense of what, there's a sense of like a momentum that you can pick up on, and sort of impetus that you just can sense. If something was in place, if this factor was in place, that would maybe free things up a bit and let other things come into being. So just worthwhile reflecting on that. Okay. So now we'll go back to the previous lines. Her two hands are the two truths. Her right hand, the conventional truth. Her left hand, the ultimate truth. So it's more about wisdom, isn't it? Description of the chief lady of compassionate action. And we're hearing again more about how she embodies wisdom. So that in itself just something to ponder and take on board. I was thinking about this afternoon. I remembered that this reflected this sort of aspect of Kara, the embodiment of wisdom and compassionate action, reflected my experience of practicing Uttara Sadhana in the first few years that I was doing that. And I remember someone asked me, oh, was doing the Green Tara practice making me more compassionate? And, well, I knew that if I did the Karuna Bhavana, I could feel compassion. But it didn't make me... Actually, my answer was no. That wasn't my actual experience. I mean, I may or may not have been more compassionate, but my actual experience of doing the sadhana wasn't actually one that was connected with compassion. It was one that was connected more with wise reflection. I wouldn't say it was wisdom exactly, but certainly wise reflection. So it was quite... I remember it being quite just intriguing to follow that through. And what it was that the effect of doing the practice was prompting me... It was when I did the practice, I became aware of what my kind of inner axis of decision making was in my life. So to explain that a bit, the basis on which I made decisions was often a basis which was an axis of preference, personal preference. So, you know, like, dislike, pleasant, unpleasant. So making decisions on that kind of axis, something like you make decision to attain it or sustain it. It made me aware that a lot of the way I'd make decisions was a lot on that kind of axis of preference. So like and dislike, pleasant and unpleasant. Oh. And that was modified by practicing ethics. You know, it wasn't just out and out hedonism and I'll have it, I want it, so I'll have it. But I did make me more aware that that was the underlying basis. And I noticed that doing the practice made me more aware of that and less comfortable with it, with that axis of preference. And also in the course of doing the practice, another axis offered itself and gradually claimed priority. And that was the axis of not pleasant, unpleasant, or like-dislike, but worldly, spiritual, or worldly, unworldly, in terms of the translation of the Satipatthana Sutta we were using last week. So there, when you're being mindful of feeling, you're mindful of feeling in terms of whether it's, you know, pleasant and unpleasant, or you don't quite know, something neutral in the middle. But then the sutta adds in another layer of looking at that and says pleasant can be worldly pleasant and it can be, well, unworldly, but I tend to use the word spiritual rather than unworldly. So it can be pleasant worldly, but it can be pleasant spiritually, and it can be unpleasant worldly, but it can be unpleasant spiritually. So my experience of doing the practice was that gradually the axis of you know, merely pleasant and unpleasant, and became less comfortable. And this other axis, which was putting the emphasis more on the spiritually worldly side of it, came more to the fore. So when I say spiritual, I mean, was this? If I was going to make a decision to do something or not do something or act in some way or other, was this something that was going to help deepen my going for refuge? That's what I mean by spiritual. Or was it likely to distract me but from that, which is what I mean by worldly? So that's the kind of distinction that's enjoined on us in mindfulness of feeling. And so, yes, there are pleasant feelings, which I like. Some of them are distractions from going for refuge, and some of them are aids to that. So I was thinking about this afternoon. I was thinking it would be good to come up with some examples. And I was sitting near my desk. Now, on my desk, and I was over in my room in the house, on my desk at the moment there is a DVD box, and it arrived in the post last week while the retreat was on, and without opening it I knew what was in it. And what it is was two DVDs that a friend had recorded the last and final story of Prime Suspect.
Well, can I borrow that one?
You'll have noticed the arrival of a worldly pleasant, quickly followed by craving and clinging experience at the back. So there it was. So I hadn't even I kind of knew what it was. So there's an, that's an example of pleasant and liable to distract. An example of, I was sort of thinking, okay, what's an example just for me in the this, you know, live in me, this the retreat, is an example of pleasant and not liable to distract. So what came to mind was the joy of walking. Some of you heard me talking about this before. I've had to take myself in hand as regards getting more exercise, and have rediscovered the joys of just walking. Now, walking to me normally means hill walking, but you can't do that here. you can walk, and it's pleasant, and it's pleasant to do it. So I've rediscovered just the joys of, you know, being in your body, just exercise and walking. Even if it isn't on the level, that's become immaterial. So now, in a certain way, I wrote this down as an example of pleasant and also helpful, you know, spiritually helpful. I mean, I suppose maybe there's a query over that. I mean, I think it is helpful to me at the moment, actually, in that spiritual way, but I guess it needn't necessarily be that. But it certainly is for me at the moment. Then I was thinking of unpleasant but still spiritual. So one thing that came to mind was just showing up for the next meditation when, in anticipation, you've gone, ah, my back is sore, I might be better to lie down, maybe I should just go and have a cup of tea. You know, that sort of moments, those sorts of moments when it's not exactly pleasant to anticipate coming back in for another meditation. You know, so just the kind of the moment when you could carry on showing up, but you're not certain yet if you're going to do it. So I had thought of that as unpleasant but spiritually helpful. Another one that came to mind, though, is say, you know, when you know you've acted unskillfully, and what you're feeling is shame, that isn't pleasant, but it definitely is spiritual. So you know, hiriyaratpa. Shame, and you know you'd be ashamed when your friends find out. That's not pleasant, but it is actually a positive, very spiritually positive frame of mind to be in. Unpleasant, that leaves unpleasant worldly. So, well, there was Prime Suspect DVDs. And so I was good, you know, I'd thought, end of the retreat, blah, blah, blah. You'll really enjoy them. You're not, don't even think about it. Just, it's good that they've come. And what happened was that I got into a little bit anxious that maybe maybe they'd been formatted in a way that I wouldn't be able to. So that was definitely unpleasant and
stupid.
Pardon?
Stupid.
No, I hadn't got as far as that. As I imagine. I was definitely worldly and a distraction. And I have to confess here's the confession. I'm not sure that it's got much sense of shame in it, but I did just test them to make sure they were okay.
Did you have to test them all the way through?
No, I didn't. But I saw the opening scene. I saw the opening scene before the credits came up. So I know it's okay. But it is interesting that. I mean, it was just in my mind, and I thought, oh, maybe you should have done it the wrong way. And it wasn't very sensible to test it. It wasn't a big thing, but actually, in a way, it could have been that it didn't work. Mm. Now, actually, that actually would have
been a big thing.
That would have been a bigger thing. That would have added to the unpleasantness and the whole. I mean, it just would have given momentum. Mm. You know, there was a bit of an anxiety. Mm. I mean, a bit silly, really, and it was probably craving. It was a bit of a rationalisation to let's just make sure they work, which I followed. And as it turned out, like, it was fine, and I and it's gone. But still, I started thinking about it just now. But actually, if it hadn't been okay, I would just have added to that momentum. It was just a bit of anxiety. I could have just ignored it, really. Could have just put an antidote in. And I acted in a way that, as it happened, dissipated it, but might well not have. It might have just added to the whole momentum of distraction, and I could have dropped into disappointment, despondency. And then would I have phoned? Or, you know, it's where it goes. You go into proliferation. And that can lead to action. And from the point of view of me being on an intensive meditation retreat on the theme of mindfulness, this was not helpful. So quite a good example of unpleasant and definitely worldly. So, so use those categories. The pleasant, pleasant and unpleasant does take some, is a knack just to be able to be aware of feeling. And then it just seems like it opens up to a whole realm of practice to add in worldly and spiritual, or use worldly and unworldly as that translation does. So think about that as a, you know, it's just another axis to bring in terms of how you act in your life and how you make decisions and what gets priority and what doesn't. So all of that was coming out of just remembering my own experience of doing the Tara practice. But to go back to the lines of the verse, you know, it says the two hands are the two truths. So this is a reference to wisdom on a much deeper level than that kind of wise reflection and mindfulness of feeling. A much different deeper level than my, you know, change of axis in myself. It's a reference to the two truths of the Majjhimaka. So there's a conventional truth. So her right hand is a conventional truth. This hand is like that in gesture of giving. And her other hand represents the ultimate truth. So the conventional truth is where you're still operating within an arena of self. You haven't passed beyond that arena of self and view of self. Still carrying the consequences of that view in terms of self-pride, self-love, self-conceit. Those things are so deeply embedded in us. We don't dissipate those for, you know, without considerable effort and subtlety. So the conventional truth is still operating within that arena of self, but within that arena there are right views and wrong views. So if we're practicing from the point of view of conventional truth and following a right view within that, then we're operating from within the arena of self still, but we're applying conditionality. So when you do that, When you apply the principle of conditionality, you're acting as if you've seen through the view of self. We haven't, but we're acting as if. That's the great benefit of it. So her right hand represents that conventional truth. So it's when we practice as if, we'd seen through to the emptiness of our self, that there is indeed no inherent self, fixed self. Of course, there's the ongoing flowing self, empirical self, that is not being denied by any means. But in that realm of conventional truth, we act as if we'd seen through to emptiness by following right view, particularly conditionality. And then the ultimate truth is where you've had there's a direct experience of emptiness, and at that point, emptiness and compassion are conjoined, as it were. There's no remnants of a view of self still active. There's a direct experience of conditionality, stroke emptiness. Because I said yesterday, they're not different. They're really not two. And out of that great emptiness and experience of it comes the great compassion. Or maybe the other way around. Maybe out of great compassion comes the experience of the realization of it. It's empty. All things are empty. So it's on that depth of realization that the lines are referring. So there's a distinction being made between, on the one hand, surveying the world and seeing conditionedness of it while still working within this arena and view of inherent self. So within that, we can practice can go a long way. You can be practicing spotting when you're caught up in the, you know, viparyasas and topsy-turvy views, spotting marks of conditioned existence. So there's quite a level of practice in that, but it's still all within the arena of self. So that on the one hand, and on the other hand, having a direct experience of emptiness in the midst of conditionedness. So you see emptiness and purity in the midst of the ordinary reality, you experience ultimate reality. So one hand, conventional reality, and it's the hand that's stretched out. It's stretched out to the world, stretched out to beings. The conventional sense of the word beings. The hand is stretched out with generosity. It's as if beings had inherent existence, had inherent fixed existence, that she'd be stepping out, so the hand would be going out. So maybe if the whole business about the two truths doesn't quite get your interest, gets mine, but if it doesn't quite get your interest, just go back to it represents, there's something about these hands that represent the truth in different ways, and there's one that just steps out, moves out. Or foot stepping out as well, we'll come to that tomorrow. So it's the hand that's stretched out to beings, represents conventional reality, conventional practice of generosity and compassion. The other hand is held up in the gesture of fearlessness. So this is the one that represents the direct experience of emptiness. It's the mudra of, well, the mudra of fearlessness would be that straightforward one. This is it's a bit more particular. Now in that rupa, it's that, isn't it? Sometimes it's that. It's index. It's the second finger that's down. So that is also a gesture of fearlessness, but it's a particular fearlessness that comes from going for refuge. It's actually going for refuge, mudra, Noma told me a long time ago. So it is about fearlessness, but it's a fearlessness or the courage, even. They're not exactly necessarily the same, but we're in the same arena. That comes from going for refuge. And that's the other hand. It's the hand that's represented being having the experience of emptiness, a great mystery, a great matter, knows what's utterly reliable, and from that emanates fearlessness. Yes, so seeing the emptiness of being saved them, mentioned that sort of, it's that sort of emphasis that's there again in this hand, in both hands. You see the emptiness of being saved them. And yes, so maybe in this, you just go back to the mudras themselves. And together, I think it's interesting, you put them together, you get something like that. Mm. Which actually is kind of like, it's not quite the teaching mudra, but it's kind of like it. And I was a bit of a... I wasn't an immediate devotee of Tara when I first came across her. I was a bit of a... took a wee bit of canoodling on her part, really, to kind of get me in, and a bit of wrathfulness, actually, as I remember as well. And actually, I remember being struck at one point that when you put those two mudras together, you get that, and that's a gesture of receptivity. Mm-hmm. You're kind of ready to receive, really. Ready to catch something, ready to receive, which at a certain point in my spiritual practice meant a great deal, actually. Just being ready to receive. There's awareness and alertness, but, you know, a readiness to receive. Okay, so we're finished there. Tomorrow we go on to, yes, more about her... the gestures of her hands, but also one foot stretched out and one foot drawn back.